Hi, it's Michael Senoff with Michael Senoff's HardToFindSeminars.com. The title of this interview is called, Are You Prepared to Grow Old? Making a six-point blueprint is easier and more important than you think. We've all seen them, senior citizens who just don't seem happy. They sit around their apartments in front of the TVs, only shuffling out the door for doctor's appointments or grocery shopping. It's hard to think about growing old when you're rushing around in the fast-paced bubble of the working years. But there will be a time when it ends. And if you don't make plans for yourself, your assets, and your life, you could end up drifting through your retirement, and that could be about 20 years of drifting until your kids or the government eventually decides what should happen to you and yours. In this audio interview with aging and geriatric expert and author of A New Wrinkle, Dr. Eric Shapira, you'll hear the six areas you need to focus on to make sure you or someone you love are ready to grow old the best way possible, and it's never too late to do it. You'll also learn exactly what to do if siblings say they're going to help take care of mom or dad and then don't. You'll also hear that if you go into an assisted living facility while on Medicare, the government may pay for your care, but they will also take your assets unless you protect them. Here's how to make sure you're protected. You'll also learn the power of neurobotics on the mind, fun exercises that go beyond word puzzles to keep your mind sharp well into old age. You'll also learn how to help a parent or a loved one make plans for their old age needs. You'll hear a quick start guide to planning for obstacles that may come up, like losing a house, working part-time, dealing with feelings of identity loss, dating, money issues, and how to keep your self-esteem up through it all. You'll hear the all-important documents you need to focus on for where to go if you can't stay in your house, how to deal with family members, asset protection, and more. Retirement can be a wonderful time of reinventing yourself, becoming an entrepreneur, finally finding time to become a mentor, or anything else you might want to do. The trick is in sitting down and deciding for yourself what those things are, and then developing a flexible plan that works for you. And in this audio interview, you'll hear how to do it for yourself or someone you love. Now let's get going.
Hi, this is Chris Costello, and I've teamed up with Michael Senoff to bring you the world's best health-related interviews. So if you know anyone struggling with their weight, with cancer, diabetes, ADHD, autism, heart disease, or other health issues, send them over to Michael Senoff's HardToFindSeminars.com. Today we're talking with Dr. Eric Shapira, author of A New Wrinkle. Dr. Shapira, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you, Chris, for having me. I'm really excited about being on your show.
You've written this great book, A New Wrinkle. If our listeners want to find out more, they can go to newwrinklebook.com, and it's all about aging. One part that I loved is your chart on aging in this country and the different ages. I love that paradigm. You know, I'm looking at the big 5-0, and, you know, there you go.
Oh, you're still a kid.
Yeah, 45 to 55 adult, right? I'm finally getting to be an adult. What's going on in this culture with aging? I mean, it is such a youth-loving culture.
Yes, it's quite an interesting phenomenon, because if you lived around the year 1900, most people died at an average of 47 years old. And the fastest growing cohort of our culture today is over 85. That's almost twice the age group. It's amazing to think that we're living that long today due to many different factors. And I'm going to give you some staggering numbers right now. A person turns 50 every 7 seconds, you can believe that, and 1,000 people an hour turn 65. And according to recent statistics that I read yesterday, the demographic of people over 55 will increase 26% to about 86 million people in 2014. Right now we've got about 25% of the population 65 and above, which is a quarter of the people in this country. It's staggering. And right now, at least 42% of today's 50-year-olds plan to move when they retire, and another 72% of the younger baby boomer group plan to continue working after retirement. And 14% of those people fear they're never going to be able to retire due to the fact that we're in such a stressful economic time. And it is stressful for everyone.
That's one thing I'd like to talk with you a little bit about is the retirement issue. You know, I've rarely seen anybody that was happy retiring. I've seen a few people now where they retire, and I'm always glad when they go back to work or they do something, because, you know, I've seen them just sort of vegetate for a few months. And, you know, how does retirement work for people? What have you seen?
I don't see a lot of people retiring either. I can tell you that about 30% of the workforce over 65 is mandatorily Is that a word, mandatorily? There's mandatory retirement in the workplace. People are getting laid off. It's not their choice to retire at 65. About 25% of those people are actually doing what I did, reinventing themselves and becoming entrepreneurs to some extent. Businesses are actually taking some of the older people that were in their workforce and rehiring them at a similar or lower salary but less benefits so they don't have the overhead. It's kind of staggering to think about that. And then I've got a 6-point blueprint for the boomers in terms of aging. The first thing I would recommend is that people be prepared. That's why I like the Boy Scout motto. The only thing that's constant in life is change, and we're seeing it every moment. You know, you and I are changing right now because we're talking to each other and we're sharing information we may not be aware of. You're asking me questions I may not have thought of, and I'm giving you answers you may not have heard. So we're changing in that respect. I encourage everyone to learn to be flexible with change. If you try to fight what's happening, you're going to end up on the short end of the stick. I think we need to come to some form of acceptance around the fact that change is constant and that our lives are going to change one way or the other, whether it's planned or unplanned. The second thing on my 5-point thing is to plan to work and work to plan. So you need a strategic plan about your life, where you're going to go, how you're going to get there. A great American philosopher, Yogi Berra, once said, if you don't know where you're going, any road will take you there. Mm-hmm. He also said, when you get to the Y in the road, take it. So that's the real, you know, when you get to the fork in the road, take it. So who knows which way to go? You know, it's a choice that we make. So once we make a plan and get a hold of what I would call our core values, we need to know what we like to do and how we're going to like doing it and where we want to move. All these boomers are planning on moving to the southern states, you know, like South Carolina, North Carolina is the new Florida for the boomers. One, it's less expensive, and two, there's more things for them to do, and they're not interested in golf. They're interested in stimulating their minds and having culture, and that's a real interesting change from the elder group that's retired now. I think that if you do get to a position where you're financially set to retire or work part-time and retire the rest of the time, it's important to get out of yourself. One, you got to know yourself. I think it's important to know who you are and what you're capable of doing, how you think, and what you like to do with respect to the change. But I think that none of us really know what our gifts are until we give our gifts away. I really recommend getting out of yourself and volunteering in some aspect of volunteering, whether it be reading to elderly people who can't read because they're sight impaired, or someone in the hospital who's in a position where they can't read or do for themselves, or mentor a child or become a foster grandfather or a grandparent or a parent. I think by getting out of yourself, not only do you make a difference to somebody else, but without realizing it, you increase your self-esteem and your respect in the community and in your station in life. I think that's really an important thing. In the book, I don't know if you remember, there's a graph called The Language of Feelings. And if you have any kind of anxiety about retirement or what you're doing, or you don't know what to do, or you've tied yourself in like I did, and you get laid off, and you only think of yourself as a steam fitter, and you can't see yourself as doing anything else, and there's no job available, your self-esteem is going to go down because it's tied around your job and your identity of self. So those people that have come to me that are depressed or feeling down about being unemployed or not having a function in life, because I think the work ethic is really important for our self-esteem. We need to feel useful in our society. They need to get out of themselves. So I always recommend, again, know yourself and then challenge yourself. And that's on every plane. That's physically and mentally. And then I think forgiveness is a big part of that plan. I think, you know, we grow up with a lot of expectations that we've imbibed from our parents. You know, my mother expected me to be, you know, a brain surgeon. All right, my mother wanted me to be a horseshoer. How's that? You know, I didn't quite make it because I was afraid I was going to get kicked. So I didn't do that. And yeah, I feel guilty about not having met her expectations of me. Well, one, we have to learn to forgive ourselves for not meeting other people's expectations. And we also need to forgive them for putting their expectations on us. And we need to go back to knowing thyself and functioning in our own right and being our own person and expressing our gifts, if you will, in every plane. So those are some of the things I would recommend boomers think about. And what I help a lot of people with is what I call an elder plan or strategic elder plan, and getting their act together for the future, where I'm going to go and how I'm going to get there. What documents do I need? What do I need to put away? How do I deal with my family? Where do I want to go when I can't live in my house anymore? I'm dealing with my mother right now. She's been in a house for 63 years, and she has to move now. She has to pare down. She's beside herself.
That must be interesting, Dr. Shapira, being a clinical gerontologist, and now you're actually experiencing what you've been, I'm sure, counseling a lot of people over the years with your own mother. And how is that, going through that?
It's difficult, to say the least. People say, well, you're too young to be an aging specialist. And how can you give people advice who are older than you are? Well, I went into gerontology to learn what I had to look forward to. And I'm learning, and I've learned, and I continue to learn. It's difficult when you realize that when someone's in a home for 60 years, they've got a plethora of memories there that are very significant. You may be losing some of your short-term memory, but you basically hold on to your long-term memory with most forms of dementia. And your memories are tied into more than just thinking about something. The smells, the feeling, the taste, everything that your senses can feel are caught up in that memory bank in your brain, whether we think about it or not. So if somebody gave you a rose, Chris, you might think, gee, what a beautiful rose. You take a smell of it, and it might trigger your memory bank for the first time you went to a prom and somebody gave you a flower or something to that effect, or the first dozen roses you got from your first love. You know, those things are stacked in there in that memory bank in the hypothalamus region of your brain. So I'm dealing with a lot of history with my mother, and the fact that she was complacent for 60 years, not really understanding the financial aspects and ramifications of what she was doing, even with a reverse mortgage that we got her years ago. She's spending money like she still had it, and she doesn't understand that she doesn't have it. And there's not too much left in the reverse mortgage to the point where she will lose her house and she will have to start paying rent, which she can't afford to do.
Right. And as children, how do you deal with that issue? I've heard that recently of, you know, even dealing with parents that have Alzheimer's and they can't handle a checkbook. What are the plans? How do you deal with
these things? You need to plan. You need to have certain documents in place. You need a power of attorney. You need a durable power of health care, which allows someone to make decisions on your behalf that you've decided about way before you're in a position where you can't do anything, where you can't think about what to do for yourself, and you need someone to manifest your wishes. You need to have a legacy, which most people don't think about. I think that's a really good thing to have, where you might want to write a letter or do a video or a recording about your life and how you appreciated the people in your life, because it's the people you leave behind that are suffering, and there's no closure once you die. You know, my dad never came around when he was dying and said, I loved you. That was a real problem for all of us because we had no closure with my dad. He couldn't say it. He didn't want to say it. He was angry, and he was stuck in that mode and never got out of the anger denial state and died a very painful, unhappy man, if you will, without the realization that, you know, we all loved him very much too. I don't think he was anywhere near there. So we need to write these things down in a legacy and leave those for our children, our friends who are behind us. We also need to have a trust so we can protect our assets, because there are certain laws in place now that preclude us going into an assisted living. God forbid if we had to go into an assisted living, the government will, if you're on Medi-Cal or Medicaid or Medicare, it may pay for your being in those facilities or those types of residences. But if you have any kind of assets, they may take those assets unless you protect them. You're allowed to have a house and $2,000, but you need to do protection at least 5 years before you're ever going to go into a facility like that. And most people don't know that. And that's where their gerontologist would come in to help them with these things.
For more interviews on health, mind, body, and spirit, go to Michael Senoff's hardtofindseminars.com. What age, Dr. Shapiro, should people start looking at these sorts of things?
Oh, 25.
I'm behind schedule.
So, you know, you're still a young adult at 50. And
right.
It's time to think about where you're going, because you're up over the hump. You know, if you were born in the 1970s, you have a good 10 to 20% chance of living to be 100 these days.
Right. I would think you can't start too soon, because you really don't know what you're going to face, even at 30 sometimes, you know, as far as decision making.
Yeah, unless you're chronically ill, then you really have to put it in gear. I think it's good to plan around 50 years of age or before. If you're going to be working with your parents, it's a good time to think about yourself. So most people 50 have parents who are in their 70s, and it's really time to think about where they're going and to help them plan to make it easier, not just for them, but for you, and taking care of things that they may not be able to do at the time of their demise.
In your practice, how many people do you actually see that do this?
Very few. What I see are people in crisis. I see people coming to me with problems that they don't know how to solve. I've got a lady now, a new client that just called. Her mother's got chronic obstructive pulmonary disease. She was in the hospital. She can't fend for herself right now. She's depressed. She's not happy about her physical condition and doesn't know what to do about it, but she continues to smoke, which only exacerbates the problem. And she has to come to the conclusion herself that her health is important. So I have to counsel her. I have to find out what her values are, what her fears are, what her hopes are, what her traumas were, and then take those things and let her see how she thinks, because we don't stop to think about how we think. We just react most of the time. So it's important to see how we think on paper, whether it be with words or pictures, and then determine what we should do about our situation, our challenges, if you will, our unmet needs. I don't like to say problems. I think our unmet needs are a lot better said, so that we can function in a healthier way in the long run and make some definite plans on how we want to live the rest of our life. I said, do you have a plan for the rest of your life? She's 81. She said, no. She's just vegging out in front of the TV, and that's going to end real quick.
So with your clients, what are some of the really common themes that you see with people with aging?
Some people are lonely. I've had people that are married 65 years, and they're lonely because they've lost the spark, if you will, between the two of them, or they take each other for granted. People who are a little younger than in their 90s, thinking of two 90-year-old clients that I had that were married for 65 years. But there are a lot of people who want to date again. They don't know how. They're widows or widowers or divorced later in life, so I have to teach them. There are a lot of people using the internet for dating over 65. I end up counseling. In the book, I have a whole section on internet dating and how to choose a partner. There are caregivers of compromised spouses, and they've denied themselves intimacy because they don't want to harm the compromised spouse. And because they do that, they're not being whole, if you will. So I've did 5 years of research, and there's nothing out there. I've developed 10 stages of intimacy between a caregiver and a compromised spouse, and how they both can find intimacy in that situation, whether it be a physical or a mental compromise on the spouse's behalf. So I see those types of issues. I see money issues. I see family issues where brothers and sisters, even in their 60s and 70s, don't agree on what should happen to mom and dad. And recently I had a 71-year young woman come and say, my sister is the power of attorney and she wants to sell my parents' house and put them in assisted living. And I don't think they're ready. They're independent. They love life, yada, yada. What do I do? So I said, well, I can come and facilitate a meeting. Well, it didn't happen. The other sister didn't want me there. So I went over all the role-playing of what the scenarios could be, and this one was totally prepared and eventually got what she wanted by showing these other brothers and sisters what she learned from me. I see seniors who are isolated, who have siblings who say they're going to take care of them but don't. I'm thinking of one family I wrote about in the book with 14 brothers and sisters. I remember I had to go in and set up a mock corporation, which is something that I developed through my master's in health administration. I made each brother and sister a stakeholder in the corporation. The corporation was mom. And I had them each write out a written contract and state verbally, before they wrote it down, what they were willing to commit to with respect to mom. And that way everybody had a role in the corporation. Pretty ingenious way of dealing with it. And they went out and did that, and mom was a much happier camper, and so were the brothers and sisters, because the left hand knew what the right hand was doing. As it was, nobody knew what the other person was doing, and they always thought that the one sister was doing everything and the other sister wasn't doing anything. So all these types of miscommunication between people is what I see. Another thing I see is lack of memory happening. What do we do about that? And coupled with depression, and so I have to come in and do memory training with people or tell them how to increase their memory. You know, if you use a computer for 20 minutes a day, just surfing the net, reading a newspaper, whatever, you increase your brain power by 20%. If you do puzzles and games and those types of things, that's really helpful. But now we have a field called neurobics, where you're actually dealing with all those stacked memories I talked about. And the brain is a little child, and I teach people how to stimulate that little kid. Are you right-handed, Chris?
I sure am.
Okay, so do you ever brush your teeth with your left hand?
Oh, never.
Okay, well, try it, because you're stimulating a different part of your brain. That brain likes to be stimulated. It's a little nascent imp. The other thing that I tell people about is to get that zest of life, to go back and recapture your inner child. It's really important to capture that little curious nymph that brought us nascent curiosity and spontaneity. It's the thing that gets stuffed down inside of us when we're caught up in the rigors of living life and dealing with the stressors of society. We forget about that. We forget about having fun and enjoying the moment, because that's all we have.
You talked about all these things that can happen, but it sounds like a lot of this can really be avoided with a plan beforehand.
Yes, it can be. And that's why it's so very important to think about, what are your core values? Where do I want to go? What do I want to do? And how can I effectively be flexible around the changes that I'm going to incur in my life? And, you know, okay, you write a plan. Like the lady last night I counseled, I was talking about a plan. She said, plans never work. Things change and they never work. I said, well, you know, we have the ability to make choices in our life. We can make changes around those choices. At least if we have a plan, we have something set in motion that we can work toward. It's better than sitting there and wondering what's going to happen to us. Like 10% of what happens to me is uncontrollable, but 90% of how I react to it is what I'm in control of. I'm in control of how I react to things, and my attitude is extremely important, a positive mental attitude around that. You know, we can't change our past, and we can't change the way people act in a certain way, but we can change how we respond to things. That's really important.
So, Dr. Shapira, it really appears you mentioned that a lot of people do not deal with aging. And why do you think that is? You've seen a lot of this. What's your theory on why are we so blind to this in preparing for aging and ultimately death?
Well, like my mother, you know, I think she's got some things in place maybe I don't know about. I know she has a burial plot next to my dad. I think, you know, it's not going to happen to me kind of syndrome. What kids go through. You know, I can drive real fast. Nothing's ever going to happen to me. Or I can smoke cigarettes. I'm not going to get lung cancer. That's going to happen to somebody else. So it's not going to happen to me. It's a form of denial. And the boomers are right there in denial because we're living a fast-paced life. We're in a fast world, fast food society. We want gratification now. And we don't think about some time down the road. So why think about death when I'm enjoying my life right now? I'm playing golf 3 times a week. I'm going bowling once a week. I'm dating 3 or 4 different women. I'm partying all the time. I've got a great job. I make good living. Nothing can happen to me kind of thing. That's not me. I'm just using that for
right.
But I think it was that kind of scenario and the things that we're doing rotely every day where we've got our friends, we've got our circle of life that we're dealing with in our own microcosms. We don't think about the bigger whole and death and dying as being part of life. We need to prepare for that. I just called a buddy of mine who's a mortician and I said, I want to come in and talk about my own burial plans. You know, life's like a roll of toilet paper. The closer you get to the end, the faster it goes. And so you need to think about death as part of life and it should be a celebration. It's unfortunate that, you know, I was in China when the earthquake happened, and I was the first American in this little city of 3 million people, and they called me in. I was supposed to be there teaching on a volunteer basis, teaching hospice and palliative medicine, because they don't have any hospice there, and they don't have palliative care, and they don't know what it is, and they've got a burgeoning senior population. What do we do? Well, they just don't know. It's not a question of denial. They don't have the knowledge. They've got a low IQ when it comes to this kind of thing, and most people do. They don't know about certain things in life, and so here I am. They call me in and say, since you're the first American here, we want you to know that you're the emissary from America to China now, and we want you to help us do certain things. But first of all, I want you to talk to all the people here, and here's 1,000 people in an auditorium, and they want me to talk as a representative from the USA about the earthquake and how America is going to help China. And I taught death and dying every year for the last 4 or 5 years at San Francisco State University. I taught courses in that on a guest lecturer basis, and I'm familiar with death and dying in that sense that, you know, there's no closure when you have a disaster like that. People die. There's no chance to say goodbye. There's no chance to grieve. It just happens, and you're dealing with post-traumatic stress. And so Chinese don't like to talk about their feelings too much. They keep their cards close to their chest. And one of my jobs was to get their feelings out. And I did that through writing a legacy and had them write legacies, explain what it was. And then it's like pulling teeth from a chicken. I had one at a time get up who were willing to read what they wrote. And there were a lot of tears in the room. And I heard about it from the government. And a government official said, I heard you made my people cry. And I said, oh, God, I'm going to be incarcerated forever, or they're going to hang me. But they were very grateful because people need to get in touch with their feelings about certain things, about this kind of thing. So it's a matter of being educated, getting in touch with your feelings about it, no matter how scared you may be, because fear is just a block of unknown feelings about the unknown. Fear of the unknown is what we're afraid of most of the time. So we need to get in touch with our feelings around those things and then make a plan.
Dr. Shapira, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Chris. Live for the moment.
That's the end of our interview, and I hope you've enjoyed it. For more great health-related interviews, go to Michael Senoff's HardToFindSeminars.com.
That's the end of our interview with Eric Shapira. I hope you found it helpful. And for more great interviews on health, wellness, marketing, and business, go to Michael Senoff's HardToFindSeminars.com.